You're listening to the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway. This edition is published in the early hours of Wednesday, the 19th of April. Fox News agrees to pay nearly $800 million to settle a defamation case over the broadcast of false claims about Donald Trump's election defeat. Gunfire has continued in the Sudanese capital, Khartoum, despite a 24-hour truce agreement. And
some do still hold stereotypes and biases, or I would just say slurs, about your caste background. You realize, oh, wow, maybe I can't be as comfortable as I want to be here.
Caste discrimination follows some Indian tech workers all the way to the US. Also in the podcast, a court in Russia rejects an appeal by the detained American journalist Ivan Gershkovich. And going gone, the T-Rex skeleton that sold for more than $5 million. Fox News, the most popular cable news channel in the US, has agreed to pay nearly $800 million to settle a defamation claim after it broadcast lies about Donald Trump's election defeat in 2020. Just hours after jurors were sworn in a case brought by Dominion Voting Systems, Fox agreed to settle. Sparing Rupert Murdoch and star names like Sean Hannity and Tucker Carlson the ordeal of appearing in court. Justin Nelson, one of Dominion's lawyers, spoke outside the courthouse in the U.S. state of Delaware.
The truth matters. Lies have consequences. Over 2 years ago, a torrent of lies swept Dominion and election officials across America into an alternative universe of conspiracy theories, causing grievous harm to Dominion and the country. Today's settlement of $787,500,000 represents vindication and accountability for our democracy to endure for another 250 years. And hopefully much longer, we must share a commitment to facts.
Well, Fox had been accused of deliberately repeating false claims about Dominion's ballot machines in order to boost its ratings. Rupert Murdoch admitted knowing the vote rigging claims were crazy and damaging, but didn't step in to stop the broadcasts. I heard more about the settlement from our correspondent Michelle Fleury outside the courthouse in Wilmington, Delaware.
When lawyers for Fox left the courthouse, they were pretty tight-lipped. We sort of raced after them down the street, asking if they would sort of comment on why it took so long to settle, given that this case was first filed 2 years ago. But they have issued a written statement in which they said the settlement reflected its continued commitment to the highest journalistic standards. They went on to say, we are hopeful that our decision to resolve this dispute with Dominion amicably, instead of the acrimony of a divisive trial, allows the country to move forward from these issues. These issues, of course, being the disinformation around the 2020 US election.
And how damaging is this to Fox?
You know, I was going through their earnings for the last full year. They made a net income of sort of several billion. So it is damaging. There's no doubt it blasts a hole, but it is survivable. And I think the real risk for this company going forward had been that if the trial had proceeded and there had been dirty linen aired, and remember, already in the discovery process for this trial, there had already been a damaging deposition involving Rupert Murdoch, texts that had come to light that were embarrassing, showing Tucker Carlson, one of its sort of star presenters, criticizing Donald Trump privately, but supporting him on air. You know, more of that would have come forward, and that could have increased its legal woes. I mean, we've already seen one shareholder lawsuit that was filed ahead of the trial. Perhaps more might have followed. And remember, there is also still outstanding this $2.7 billion defamation case being brought by another election technology company called Smartmatic.
And yet, in this case, experts were saying there was quite a high burden of proof for Dominion, but still Fox didn't want to risk a trial and decided to settle.
Look, at any time you put the decision into the hands of tall jurors, I mean, you're rolling the dice. It is a risk for both parties. In this particular instance, certainly defamation, which in the US is very hard to prove, in part because you have to show intent. Half of the job had already been done before the trial had started, because in pretrial motions the judge had ruled that there was sufficient evidence to show that the statements aired by Fox were false. So they didn't have to prove that part, but they did, Dominion lawyers did have to make the case that Fox News acted with malice, with intent. And that is harder to prove. So there was always the possibility it could go either way, despite the fact that Dominion already had quite a bunch of evidence on its side. Ultimately, though, for Rupert Murdoch, as I say, you know, it avoids the airing of Dirty Lemon, and perhaps for him personally, it avoids the prospect of him having to take the stand.
Michelle Fleury outside court in Wilmington. After 4 days of fierce fighting in Sudan, the rival wings of the armed forces there are supposed to be observing a 24-hour truce. Sudan's military ruler, Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, and his deputy turned rival, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, agreed the humanitarian pause after pressure from the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken. But in the hour after the ceasefire came into effect, gun and tank fire could be heard once again. Violence has terrorised the millions of people who live in Khartoum. At least 185 people have been killed across Sudan since Saturday, while aid workers and diplomats have been attacked. The Director General of the World Health Organization, Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus, called for immediate action to help civilians.
WHO calls on all parties to comply with their obligations under international law. Healthcare facilities and workers must never be a target, especially in a situation like this, where there are thousands of civilians who need access to emergency care. I want to be very clear. All parties must ensure unrestricted and safe access to health facilities for those injured and everyone in need of medical care.
For the latest on whether the ceasefire was having any effect, I spoke to the BBC's Emmanuel Igunza, who is monitoring events from the Kenyan capital, Nairobi.
The fighting has not died down at all. There was this supposed to be a ceasefire between the two warring factions of the military, the armed forces, but that has not really held. We do understand from people who've been talking to in the capital Khartoum and also in other cities across Sudan that fighting is ongoing. There is still heavy gunfire, heavy explosions being experienced in the capital. People were supposed to have gone out with this ceasefire to try and get food supplies, people who are injured to get medical attention, but that has not really been able to happen because the fighting is still really heavy and many people are still quite afraid of going outside to seek for help.
Yeah, now the US Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, spoke to both of these rival generals and they agreed this truce, but perhaps are they not in control of their fighters?
That seems to be the case, because if you look at the social media and their propaganda media wings, they've all been saying that they are ready to have this ceasefire to try and allow for talks to happen, to allow people to get medical attention, to get food. But then on the ground, particularly outside the capital Khartoum, and this has been the main concern, that the fighting has gone on in other places apart from the capital. Fighting has raged on, and it doesn't seem that these two generals at the moment can control their troops, and more importantly, they seem to be so way apart in terms of how they see the situation in Sudan should be handled, how the fighting should be stopped. And with the rhetoric coming from them, they do seem to want to fight this out until the end.
And there have also been reports that the Russian mercenary group Wagner have been seen in Sudan. Are you hearing anything about that?
Yes, indeed. And this is not something new. The Rapid Support Forces, which are led by the second in command in Sudan, Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, the Wagner group has trained many of the fighters. We've seen pictures of them, some of them being in places, particularly in the west of the country, in places like Darfur. And this has been the concern, that if the fighting that has been ongoing now involves parties not just inside Sudan, that this could then escalate into a civil of war, and with the parties like the Fanya military group being involved, it could get into an even worse situation.
Emmanuel Igunza in the Kenyan capital, Nairobi. An 84-year-old white man in the U.S. state of Missouri has been charged with shooting a black teenager who rang his doorbell by accident. Andrew Lester has been charged with first-degree assault and armed criminal action for allegedly firing two shots at 16-year-old Ralph Yarl, who'd been trying to collect his younger brothers. Doctors say they have no idea how he survived after being hit in the head and arm. A prosecutor said there was a racial component to the shooting in Kansas City. Mr. Lester has now been released on bail. Our North America correspondent Nomia Iqbal is in Kansas City, and she told James Kumarasamy more about the case.
He was taken into custody. A lot of people are angry that it took so long. It was 4 days after the shooting, alleged shooting. He's paid part of his bail, so he's been released pending his arraignment, which should happen in the next couple of days. He says this was self-defense. He is 84 years of age. He's an old man. The doorbell rang late at night, and he has told police that Ralph Yarl's tall height scared him. But his family and many people in the community say actually it wasn't the height they believe that scared Mr. Lester, it was Ralph's skin colour. Ralph is now at home recovering, and his mother, Cleo Nagby, spoke to the American network CBS.
Ralph was shot on top of his left eye, that I would say in the left frontal lobe, and then he was shot again in the upper right arm. The residual effect of that injury is going to stay with him for quite a while.
Nomia, yeah, I mean, it seems remarkable perhaps that he survived, but in terms of what impact this is having locally, how would you assess it?
People are really angry, and I spoke to one woman who's come down to protest at a rally, and she did say to me, when I asked her how she felt about the charges, a lot of people think that Andrew Lester should be charged with attempted murder. She said given Lester's age, if he is convicted on one of those charges, he could face the rest of his life behind bars. And so she said that would be justice to her. But, you know, the point that I want to make also is what's extraordinary about this wasn't a mass shooting. You know, I report on mass shootings a lot. People with troubled histories using guns. This is almost the other side. Armed American citizens in their homes reaching for their guns straight away out of fear. And in New York State, there was something similar that happened. A 20-year-old woman happened to pull into the wrong driveway, and she was shot dead by the homeowner, who has now been charged with second-degree murder. Every day, passing mistakes met by gunfire here in America.
Nomia Iqbal in Kansas City in Missouri. The first American journalist to face espionage charges in Russia since the Cold War, Ivan Gershkovich, has had an appeal against his pre-trial detention rejected. The Wall Street Journal reporter is accused of attempting to obtain classified information, but no evidence has been published. Mr. Gershkovich strongly denies the accusations. The 31-year-old will continue to be held in the notorious Lefortovo prison, previously used by the KGB to interrogate political prisoners. Our Russia editor, Steve Rosenberg, was at the court hearing.
In Moscow today, Ivan Gershkovich was brought to a courthouse for an appeal hearing. The same court where yesterday a Kremlin critic had been sentenced to a quarter of a century in prison. The judge rejected Mr. Gershkovich's appeal. He will remain in pre-trial detention. It was the first time we'd seen the Wall Street Journal reporter since his arrest for espionage nearly 3 weeks ago, a charge he and his newspaper categorically reject. Wearing light blue jeans and a check shirt, the American journalist stood calmly in the dock, a bulletproof glass cage. In court with him was the U.S. ambassador to Russia, Lynn Tracy.
We will continue to provide all appropriate support to Ivan and his family, and we expect Russian authorities to provide continued consular access to Ivan. The charges against Ivan are baseless, and we call on the Russian Federation to immediately release him.
His lawyer, Tatiana Noshkina, has visited Mr. Gershkovich in Lefortovo prison. She told me how the American journalist is spending his time there.
He read a lot of books, and he told us that maybe he will write some good novel about himself at the end of the story.
The U.S. authorities have classified Ivan Gershkovich as wrongfully detained. His case has been referred to the US Special Envoy for Hostage Affairs, who will try to secure his release.
Steve Rosenberg in Moscow. The authorities in the US, meanwhile, have announced further charges against individuals alleged to have been running Russian influence campaigns in America. Among them are four people from Florida and three Russian intelligence officers, as Sasha Schlichter reports.
The Russians were said to have recruited US citizens to act as illegal agents and to have covertly funded candidates for local office. One FSB officer, Alexander Ionov, allegedly recruited the four Florida residents to get involved in political groups, including the African People's Socialist Party. They were meant to participate in the influence campaign and act as agents of Russia in America. In a separate case, a Russian national, Natalia Burlinova, was charged with conspiring with an FSB officer to act as an illegal agent in the United States. She allegedly sought to recruit U.S. academics and researchers to travel to Russia for a Moscow-funded program devoted to promoting Russian national interests. The Justice Department said Moscow's efforts to secretly influence U.S. elections would not be tolerated.
Sasha Schlichter. Still to come on the Global News podcast.
He has his first meal of the day at 6 a.m. and his second and final at 11 a.m. He takes 54 tablets a day and off-label drugs.
The things people do to stay young forever. South Korea's economy has long been dogged by accusations of nepotism in the workplace. Now the car company Kia has asked its trade unions to drop a policy that gives jobs to the children of its workers. The government has been putting pressure on major employers to stop giving jobs to relatives of existing employees. Our Asia-Pacific editor Celia Hatton told me more.
Kia is one of, it seems, the last big South Korean companies to really maintain these practices. Less than 10 years ago, a quarter of South Korean companies had these rules in place. They're called hereditary employment rules. And basically, they give really preferential treatment to, in Kia's case, the children of retired workers or workers who've worked more than 25 years. They also say that if a worker dies of an illness while still employed at the company, then one of the immediate family members of that worker can take that person's place. So really a kind of hands-on jobs down through family lines. I mean, the president, Yoon Suk-yeol, he actually made this a key part of his election campaign. He said he wanted to level the playing field and increase fairness. And that actually got him a lot of votes, I think, because that's a real issue in South Korea. A lot of people feel that it's really unfair. There's a lot of competition to get into university, a lot of accusations between political parties of whose officials' children have been able to get into university through the back door. In fact, even in President Yoon's case, he's had two cabinet members have to withdraw from the process because it became clear that one had secured admission for his children into medical school. The other one had to admit that he'd helped his children gain admission into U.S. university. And so this is a big problem in South Korea.
And these reforms are coming in at a tough time for some in South Korea.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there really is a lot of competition for good jobs. Just for example, at Hyundai, that's the biggest automaker in the country, for the first time in 20 years, they opened up their hiring to the public and it overloaded their website because so many people were trying to apply. Now, these are really good jobs in South Korean terms because of the contracts that really powerful unions have been able to negotiate. They offer school tuition for South Korean children, paid overseas trips every year, and of course, huge car discounts. So people really want these jobs, and that's why they're furious that in some cases, such good jobs are being passed down to the children of workers.
Our Asia Pacific editor, Celia Hatton. Hillary Clinton hosted a ceremony on Monday in honor of women involved in the Northern Ireland peace process. The former US Secretary of State awarded medals to former party leaders and other key figures. It's part of an effort to ensure that the contribution of women is fully recognised during the commemoration of the Good Friday Agreement, signed 25 years ago. Our Ireland correspondent Chris Page has this report.
The deal signed on Good Friday 1998 was the main turning point on Northern Ireland's journey from conflict to peace.
I'm pleased to announce that the two governments and the political parties of Northern Ireland have reached agreement.
I kept nipping my leg so that I wouldn't cry, but I just couldn't hold back. I just thought it was tremendous. It was a tremendous achievement.
Dawn Purvis was a negotiator with the Progressive Unionist Party, which she went on to lead for 3 years.
The politics of fear ensures that everything stays exactly as it is, that nothing changes.
Certainly within my own party, I always felt supported, but external to that, yes, you faced misogyny all the time. You faced comments. I had prominent members of political parties who shall remain nameless just letting the door go and closing it on your face. Things like that. Very disrespectful when you look back at how women were treated if they got to the floor to talk by other political parties. Some of the language was horrendous.
One of the women who was involved in politics during the whole of the conflict was Breeze Rogers from the Nationalist SDLP.
I think if the women, when we started in civil rights, which was the beginning of people saying, recognising that the way forward was political and peaceful and not through violence. And there were key women in that movement, like Edwina Stewart, who was a teacher from East Belfast and actually lost her job because of her position on civil rights. There was Betty Sinclair, who was again from the unionist community and stood up to be counted for civil rights. And there were different women along the way. I suppose the role of women like that was underplayed, I think, which is nothing new in Irish history, of course.
The ceremony hosted by Hillary Clinton is part of an effort to change the historical narrative. The women she's honouring think that there has been a shift in perspectives, but also that prejudice is still present.
It didn't bother us too much because we weren't really in it for the glory. We were in it to see the thing working. 25 years later now, people recognise it. They also do not tolerate the misogyny that I had to put up with. So when you transform a society from conflict, that's part of it. You need to change those attitudes as well, that women are not subordinate, and they're not objects to make derogatory comments about. And I'm hopeful now that the next generation see that, and that's what equality is about.
Breed Rogers ending that report by Chris Page. The US tech sector employs many thousands of Indian workers, but it seems the discrimination experienced by some castes in India has followed them to America. The caste system divides people in India into groups of different social status according to birth, with Dalits considered the lowest. Allegations of caste discrimination first emerged in the US in 2020. And since then, a civil rights group for Dalits has received more than 250 complaints of discrimination at major American tech firms. Many of the victims are too afraid to speak out. But California-based journalist Sonia Paul has managed to find some willing to tell us their stories.
There were three people who were willing to let their voice go to air. Sidan, who works at Facebook's parent company Meta, Harsha, who works at Microsoft, and Sam Cornelius, who didn't want his current company mentioned. Harsha had a very probing conversation with one of his managers who was basically trying to find Harsha's caste background. And once that manager determined what it was, Harsha, who had like very positive performance evaluations, got really poor reviews. Sam, he had this experience at a work dinner where caste came up and he was just trying to give a perspective about how people from his caste background feel about caste. He really started to feel alienated at his workplace. But what really set the stage for what happened because of his talk about caste was that his company sent him back to India. They said that he's no longer needed in the US.
I think it was, you know, less than 4 to 6 weeks when he informed me that I have to go back to India. So that was like literally a shocking to me. I could see no other relation than what happened in that meeting. It was devastating for me because I had to quickly, right in the middle of the school year, plan for my kids to come back to India.
Sam Cornelius and not his real name? And are there risks in these people speaking out?
Yes, I think a lot of it has to do with the fact that so many of the people who are facing caste discrimination are here on precarious immigration statuses. Especially in Silicon Valley, the professional networks are really close-knit. You really can't discount the psychological burden of even just coming from this caste background, right? And some do still hold some biases, or would just say slurs about your caste background. You realize, oh, maybe I can't be as comfortable as I want to be here because who knows what might happen. I don't think colleges and universities would consider adding caste as a protected category if they didn't think it was necessary. Seattle in the U.S. recently added caste as a protected category. And Senator Aisha Wahab, who is representing a district in the Bay Area, she has also proposed a bill to explicitly ban caste discrimination in California.
Sonia Paul, and you can find her full investigation, the documentary Hidden Caste Codes of Silicon Valley, on BBC Sounds. The first complete T-Rex skeleton ever auctioned in Europe has sold for more than $5 million in Switzerland. Nicknamed Trinity, the 67-million-year-old specimen is made up of the bones of three different dinosaurs unearthed in the US. But its price tag has raised concerns about the privatisation of historical artefacts. Our science correspondent Palab Ghosh reports.
4,800,000 francs, going once, going twice, und zum.
There are only around two dozen good T-Rex skeletons in the world, and experts say that this is one of the bigger and better ones. It's the latest dinosaur specimen to have been sold at auction to private collectors for millions, amounts which few, if any, museums can compete with, according to Professor Steve Brusatti, a dinosaur expert at Edinburgh University.
What worries me is that these very rare dinosaur skeletons, which scientifically are very valuable, that these skeletons are disappearing into the vaults of super rich collectors, because any time a fossil goes up for auction, that means it's not available for science, it's not available usually for public display.
But other scientists say that many privately owned specimens end up being loaned to museums. And the Swiss auction company that sold the dinosaur says it hopes that Trinity will be available to be seen by the public too. But it's unclear at this stage what the new owner plans to do.
Palab Ghosh. Now, what lengths would you go to never grow old?
I let a system of science and data run my body. It does a better job taking care of me than I can.
That's Brian Johnson, CEO of Kernel. He's a middle-aged American tech multimillionaire who's decided to devote himself and much of his money to finding the secret to having a long and healthy life. Lara Lewington from the BBC's technology programme Click has been investigating this new industry for a programme called Forever Young that will air this weekend. Michelle Hussain asked Lara what Brian does as part of his anti-ageing regime.
Well, where to start? He's quite a character. He wakes up at 5 o'clock every morning. Obviously, you'll be familiar
Lion.
With that. And then he has his first meal of the day at 6 a.m. and his second and final at 11 a.m. He takes 54 tablets a day, which is a mix of supplements that are carefully planned based on tracking of his entire body and organs, and off-label drugs, which are prescription drugs that he's managed to get his hands on because he believes they have anti-aging purposes. So 30 scientists are working with him on this really extreme regime.
Is he his own lab then? Is he doing this because he then wants to sell whatever he comes up with, or is he already selling it?
He was very successful very young. So he already has a lot of money and is spending a great deal of it on trying to reduce his biological age. So for him, this is a very personal exercise. But yes, he is also selling parts of the plan, only some very basic elements, because a lot of it is still being tested. He is effectively a human experiment. But he aged young from the stress of what he was doing. His hair went grey at 27 and he wanted to feel better himself. And he now treats this as a sport.
But this idea of reducing your biological age, that's different to the idea of just looking younger, is he? Is that actually what he's trying to do, to reverse the ageing of his cells?
Absolutely, that's it. And so it's reducing the biological age, the age that his organs seem. There are different ways of trying to assess the age and health of each organ. And I mean, a lot of this stuff is not proven. It's all being tested. He's happy to have just thrown himself into it, to have all this stuff tried on him, and he's not going to sue if it goes wrong. So this is all very experimental. But then, for example, his hearing, he has the hearing age of a 64-year-old. And they're struggling to do anything to reverse that. But of course, anything that they do achieve could be hugely useful. If they did achieve anything with the hearing, that would be great for people who are hard of hearing. But they're not making progress in all areas. They only are in some areas of the body. His skin, they've managed to reduce that by 22 years.
So how does he look then? What does his skin look like?
Well, this is the thing that's slightly difficult, because you look at him and he doesn't look particularly young for his age. He's 45, and I would say, close up, he looks 45, but like he's had a facial. His skin looks very, very clear, and this laser that he's doing all over his body has apparently reduced the age by that much, and that's judged by putting his face in a machine that looks at sun damage. So it's kind of taking away the sun damage, so reducing the biological age, but he's still got the lines there that you'd expect any 45-year-old to have, some fine lines.
Lara Lewington talking to Michelle Hossain. And that's all from us for now, but the Global News podcast will be back very soon. This edition was mixed by Caroline Driscoll and produced by Emma Joseph. Our editor is Karen Martin. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.